From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're discussing a cold case, an unsolved murder from the 1970s. Investigative journalist Eric Peterson's been exploring the case of Anthony Adams, a young black gay man who was murdered in his Avenue's apartment in 1978. No one's been charged in the murder, and there are a lot of theories about what happened, some pretty explosive. The story examines the effect of the murder on Salt Lake's gay community at the time. We'll be right back.
With the KUER app, you'll never have to choose between Doug Fabrizio and a phone call from your spouse. Just hit the pause button and take the call. When you're ready, hit play and it's back to Radio West. The KUER app lets you pause whatever you're listening to, and you can get a constant feed of BBC News and classical music with our other streams. BBC on KUER and KUER Classical. It's even got an alarm clock, so you can wake up with Diane Mezzapinto's Moon Report and Morning Edition. Download the KUER app for iPhone and Android today. It'll help you be a better partner.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. 40 years later, no one knows for sure who killed Anthony Adams. Anthony was 25 years old. He was gay, African-American, and a pretty engaged activist for the Socialist Workers' Party. On November 6th of 1978, he was brutally stabbed 7 times in his apartment in the Avenues. The case still hasn't been solved. And what interested Eric Peterson about the story is just how it fit in the time. Anthony was part of a gay community that was just emerging out of the shadows, starting to become politically active, not to mention his own work with the socialists. In his 2-part series that appeared recently in the Salt Lake Tribune, Peterson described that time as a heady mix of joy and terror. Remember, there was a lot of violence directed at the gay community and political radicals at the time. The San Francisco activist Harvey Milk had just been killed. And aside from Anthony Adams, 2 other gay people were mysteriously murdered in Salt Lake City that fall. Their murders haven't been solved either. Today in the program, we're talking about Eric Peterson's story. He's the executive director of the Utah Investigative Journalism Project. His articles, as I said, appeared in the Salt Lake Tribune. We have links to that on our website, radiowest.org.
Well, a lot happened in November 1978, especially here in Salt Lake City. Key to this story, Anthony Adams, a young man. He's an activist. He's active in a lot of different causes, a lot of things people call radical politics back then. He's a black man. He's gay. He's a socialist. He's involved in a lot of different protests, rallies, different causes. And the weekend of the election, Anthony Adams goes home. He's a bus driver. He's been working. He's taken a little bit of time off that weekend. He had toothache, got a tooth pulled. He's trying to recover for a political rally on Sunday. He's working on the campaign of a man who's running for Congress, for the Socialist Workers' Party. He never makes the rally. It's not till, you know, the following, I think it's Monday, after that weekend, he's discovered. He's found in his Avenue's apartment, and he's naked. He's been stabbed repeatedly in the neck and the chest. And he's found this way. And everything that happens after then really kind of really sets the stage for a lot of the work I did on these series of stories, looking at how this investigation unfolded, how it was that a person who was really kind of a part of, you know, not the mainstream for Salt Lake City in 1978, you know, how was his death investigation handled and looked into, and how did the community react to his death?
Yeah. How did you get started? How did you first learn of the story of Anthony Adams?
Years ago, I remember the police department had put up a little thing on their website where they're kind of highlighting cold cases, and they're just trying to get the public interested. And I think this might have been at a time that they kind of started, like, kind of revamping and putting more effort into solving some old cases. And there's a little blurb about Anthony, and there's a really kind of strange, kind of vague line at the bottom that said something to the effect of, Anthony is involved in radical groups. And, like, that's all it said. And that piqued my interest. Then when I looked into Anthony a little bit more, found there's only really one article that had been put out about Anthony. I could see it was Ben Williams wrote up a little write-up about it and kind of explained a little bit about what happened at that time. And I was just fascinated by that story from that point on. And something I kind of thought about for a long time, but it wasn't until last couple of years I decided, you know, I'm going to do this story and really, really dig into it.
So for you, and the way you're pursuing it, Eric, is it's more than just a murder case there, because it's connected to a couple of really interesting things. A community, the gay community, and where it is or happens to be in the 1970s, which is interesting, and we'll get into that. But also this kind of social activism, I have to say, element is strange and intriguing too. So there's a lot of sort of undercurrents here that I guess interested you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think from, especially from kind of my background as a reporter, I mean, I do a lot of enterprise stuff and haven't really worked a lot of specific beats, but I've always kind of considered myself more of a political reporter. But I'm also a person that kind of tends to see everything in political terms. And especially looking at this case, I felt like this is just kind of a political story. It's about, you know, different kind of views of power and the community and different voices trying to be heard, and a really kind of shocking murder that really affected the gay community at that time, especially at a time when they were really starting to, you know, assert kind of their voice in the community.
Yeah. Anthony is, you describe him soft-spoken. He was confident. He was very active, engaged politically, but not strident. Quiet warrior is the term you used to describe him, or have heard,
right,
I guess.
Yeah, you did get that impression. I mean, he was very active. He was very passionate about his beliefs, but he was not the type of person that was, you know, like, you know, yelling in people's faces or spitting at them or anything like that. You know, like, he had his convictions, and he stood up for them. Yeah, quite bravely, I think, especially for the times. But he was not, you know, he was not that aggressive, you know, in-your-face aggressive.
Yeah. Went to Judge High School. Sounds like he's a really successful student. But at some point, I guess, his faith, as you write about it, started to conflict with his sexuality.
Yeah, and he was raised Catholic, and it seemed pretty clear, you know, as he grew up, as he matured, he kind of had to reconcile his sexuality with his faith. And he kind of had an interesting faith journey, you know, like, I think he had a bit of a falling out, I guess you might say. But, you know, he did come around to finding acceptance. You know, there's this gay-friendly church, and, you know, he became part of that.
This was the Metropolitan Community Church. Bob Waldrop was the minister at the time, yeah.
Correct, yeah. I became friends with Bob Waldrop, and it was also, you know, they were also kind of a politically active church, too.
Yeah.
So that kind of fit in, too, with his beliefs.
So this murder happens, and we'll get into the investigation and how that played out. But it basically goes cold. And it goes cold for 40 years. Mm. How does it start to, well, I guess this, why did the Salt Lake City Police Department think about reopening the case? How does that happen?
Well, from what I understand, it was I think it was when they kind of were really trying to rebuild their kind of cold case unit, I guess you could say. I believe it, like, in the late 2000s, they got some grant money, you know, and I think they realized, okay, well, this is a time we can, you know, let's seriously look back at some of these cold case files. See, is there stuff we can test for DNA? You know, can we, you know, go back and look at these, see if there's any new leads, things like that. So I think Anthony's case was a part of, you know, that in general, that kind of looking at their old files and trying to see what they could do with it.
What was it like if you were gay in a conservative place like Salt Lake City in the late 1970s? I'm guessing, were people having to live underground, or were they just emerging from that place? What was it like at that particular time?
Well, I mean, you know, again, based on kind of like interviews I did, it sounds like, you know, it's probably a bit of both. You know, I think there was definitely an emergent kind of culture. Like, I think a lot of people were starting to kind of embrace just being gay and having that community and not kind of like living in the shadows. But, you know, there's still a lot of, you know, conservative, you know, elements and kind of currents running through, you know, Salt Lake City and Utah. And so there are some people still, you know, not quite accepting, not quite being able to be as out as they might want to be. Yeah. But in some ways it seems, you know, volatile, you know, like, I mean, it must have been exciting, but also kind of terrifying too. You know, people are finally finding a community and speaking as a community, and, you know, some elements that, you know, not approve of that community at all are for the first time seeing a gay community speaking, you know, as one, or, you know, kind of asserting themselves. And so naturally there's going to be pushback.
It's interesting you describe it in your piece as a heady mix of joy and terror. So there's those two things playing out, I guess.
Yeah.
It's a perfect time to bring in another voice into the conversation. Ben Williams is with us. He's an independent historian of Utah's LGBTQ community, writes about the state's queer history for Q Salt Lake City, including stories about the Adams murder. You can find links to that, by the way, on our website. But Ben Williams, welcome to you. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Same question. What was it like if you were gay in a conservative place like Salt Lake City in the late 1970s?
I think it was very similar to any place that was religiously conservative. The only difference is that there was one religion that dominated here. The 1970s was a difficult time for coming out because there was a response from the LDS Church that was pretty almost rabid against homosexuality. They saw homosexuality as really a threat to the stability of the state and to their church. There was a lot of articles coming out in the late 70s in the church news that was published condemning homosexuality. And so there was kind of a general climate of not acceptance. There was a lot of purges going on at BYU against gay people that attended that university. I think there's just a lot of misunderstanding at that time, a lot of fear, a lot of uneducated people. In 1978 was kind of an interesting year anyway. That was the year that the ban on blacks in the priesthood came out in June of 1978. Right. So there was a change going on. At the same time, there was an article in the Salt Lake Tribune that somebody speaking from the vice squad said that Salt Lake City was a dynamite ground for busting homosexuals. In fact, it was so extreme at that time that the chief of police actually wanted signs posted in all the Salt Lake City public parks showing that lewd behavior was a misdemeanor. And it was approved, but only one was ever really put in place, and that was at Liberty Park. That was there for about 30 years. They finally decided they didn't have the funding to put these signs signs on all the other Salt Lake parks.
It's interesting. So you, on one hand, you have what sounds like a lot of hostility still in the community, but then you have the gay community itself that's kind of, as Eric mentioned, wanting to assert itself, seeing some political opportunities. What are you seeing there?
The 1970s are really a pioneer time. Huh. Gay liberation came to Salt Lake City in 1969, so it was really the 1970s. And it's actually the University of Utah that hosted a lot of seminars for this gay liberation that helped bring this idea about. And it was happening nationally, too, across the nation. And so you have some pioneer groups coming out, like the Royal Court of the Golden Spike Empire, the Metropolitan Community Church. Mm-hmm. So there were some organizations, but the majority of the gay community at that time was centered around the bars. The premier bar for gay and straight people was the Old Sun, Joe Redburn's bar. Mm-hmm. And that became a kind of a de facto community center. So they were trying to do things. They established a gay community center in 1975. It didn't last, but they started having newspapers. But to say that, you probably could count within 100 people of who were really doing things in the community that was willing to put their name in papers and that were
who were out.
Who were out.
Yeah.
The community basically evolved, you know, socializing, having a good time at the bars and things like that. It was at the beginning, you know, at the beginning stages of creating a community. The Queer Student Union, which at that time was called the Lesbian and Gay Student Union of Utah, was established in 1976. Mm. And MCC came in 1973 or 1972, I can't recall right away. But these were the early organizations. And the Royal Court came in 1975. And these became powerhouse organizations around the community began to coalesce.
So the community is starting to coalesce, and then there's this burst of violence. I guess there's a parallel, Ben, between what's happening nationwide, and I'm thinking of San Francisco in particular and Harvey Milk. He's starting to mobilize
The Bridge Initiative that happens, you know, in basically October. Even Salt Lake City was having fundraisers, the gay community, to defeat the Briggs Initiative, which would ban homosexuals from being teachers in California. And so there was a lot of activism going on at the time because of the politics that were going in California, but not so much the politics here in Salt Lake City.
Yeah. So this burst of violence that comes, one of the things, Eric, that comes up in the piece is this idea that for a time there was a climate of violence that really was threatening the gay community, not only threats and people getting jumped at bars, but as you document in your story and mentioned, there were a number of murders.
Right. Yeah, it's a very troubling thing to look at, you know, this kind of series of murders within the gay community within such a short span of one another.
And okay, so Anthony is killed, and then 3 weeks later,
Doug Coleman. Same month,
another gay man is shot and killed.
Yeah, he's shot and killed on the west side, Salt Lake City. And another case I looked at happened some months later. It was probably April 1979. It was Mona Ulibarri. And she was a lesbian woman and appeared as if she was raped and murdered. So that's all within a pretty short period of one another. And plus, even just looking at November, you know, Anthony Adams, Doug Coleman in Utah, and I think Doug Coleman was killed just, I think it was only a few days after Harvey Milk got killed in California.
Yes.
Yeah.
So Harvey Milk, the death of Tony Adams, and we knew him as Tony Adams,
yeah.
So I'll probably be saying that
That's
a
fine.
Lot.
Absolutely.
He was killed somewhere around about like November 3rd, but then Harvey Milk was killed around the 27th. Of November, and then Doug Coleman was killed on the 30th of November. And so there was this heightened fear that started to affect the community, that people who were out, people who were vocal, people that were involved in social justice issues were being targeted.
You mentioned in your piece, Eric, that gay community leaders they actually met with the chief of police, Bud Willoughby, at the time, because they were, as Ben mentioned, really worried.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a real moment of kind of like rallying after Anthony's death. And there's a lot of, you know, kind of demands for, you know, serious investigations, you know, meeting with the police. And, you know, I think the sentiment that, you know, was passed on was the police saying, you know, you may think that we don't like, you know, gay community members, but, you know, we don't like murders, you know, either. So we're taking this very seriously and we're investigating it. But nevertheless, it still seemed like there were a lot of kind of just kind of political complications in the investigation right off the bat, it seems like.
What do you mean by that?
Well, you take into account, just looking, you look at the kind of the general climate, as we've kind of been talking about, and kind of this friction between this kind of new community voice and kind of more conservative old guard kind of feelings. But you also look at specific things, they're actually documented, in the police reports. For example, at the outset of the investigation, there are members of the Socialist Workers Party, talking to the police saying, yes, let's work together. Let's figure out what happened here. And at some point, the police had actually developed a sketch and a photo of a suspect. It's actually a suspect they were looking at for the Doug Coleman killing, but they thought, well, is this possible? They're related. And they went to the Socialist Workers and showed a couple of them the photo, and the workers were like, well, can we have a copy of this? And the police said, no, why don't you just give us your membership list and we'll talk to your members individually about it. You can see how that was, can at least be viewed.
Raise some eyebrows.
Yeah. We're still in the Cold War at this point, and you have law enforcement wanting lists of people, and controversial, political association. There was a genuine feeling, that was something meant to say. Maybe it was a message saying you got to quit making so much noise about this investigation, or it can go a different way that's really investigating you guys.
Yeah. It seems so quaint now that socialists would be so controversial, but as you point out, it was the Cold War in those days. And it's a pretty serious claim that the police in some way may have been trying to harass Utah socialists. Were you able to pin any of that down?
Well, I mean, it's just something that, I mean, I don't know that there was any like concrete proof. I've spoke to one of the detectives who was involved in kind of some of those conversations, and members of the party at the time too. And I think, the detectives will say they were just trying to advance this investigation, move it along. Whereas, some of the folks that were with the Socialist Workers Party felt like, no, this was a kind of a threat.
The Socialist Workers Party, in fact, believed that it was a political assassination.
Yeah.
The death happened just days before the election, in November election in 1978, and they actually involved the FBI and wanted an investigation of whether Tony Adams' civil rights had been violated through his murder. One of the main people that kept this story going was the pastor of MCC, the Metropolitan Community Church, named Bob Waldrop. He was a very good friend of Tony Adams, and he was the one that actually took orange spray paint and sprayed all downtown. There was a lot of construction going on at that time, so there was a lot of wooden walls, and he sprayed painted all over downtown who killed Tony Adams.
Yeah.
That stayed up there for many years.
Yeah.
I mean, many months, excuse me. And he's the one that initiated the contacts with the police department. He also had a private meeting with Mayor Ted Wilson at that time, and who promised to get to the bottom of it. Bob Waldrop was a very politically active person, as well as pastor of MCC. And he tried to raise money to fund an investigation of the murder of Tony Adams, it threatened actually his career, because the board of directors of MCC told Bob Waldrop that he needed to cool it, that they were afraid of being so active in the community.
That's Ben Williams. He's an independent historian who writes about the state's queer history for Q Salt Lake. Eric Peterson is the executive director of the Utah Investigative Journalism Project. His articles about the murder of Anthony Adams appeared recently in the Salt Lake Tribune. We have links for that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
K KUER's community of sustainers do so much for the station. Because of their ongoing contributions, we're able to bring you award-winning local news, NPR coverage, Radio West, and our own podcasts. Starting at $5 a month, you can be a sustainer too. Then, next time you hear a story you love, you'll know you made it happen. Become a sustainer at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about a cold case, an unsolved murder from the 1970s. Investigative journalist Eric Peterson has been exploring the case of Anthony Adams, a young black gay man who was murdered in his Avenue's apartment in 1978. No one has been arrested or charged in the murder, and there are a lot of theories about what happened, some pretty explosive, a crime of passion, maybe a political assassination, or a hate crime. The story examines Salt Lake's gay community at the time, just finding its voice, but Adams' death and other acts of violence may have driven it back underground. Eric Peterson is the executive director of the Utah Investigative Journalism Project. His articles appeared recently in the Salt Lake Tribune. Socialist Workers' Party had this theory, Eric, that you write about, that Tony Adams, Anthony Adams, was being enlisted by vice officers as a confidential informant, which is another intriguing twist in this story. You want to say something about that?
Yeah. I mean, it's that's another one of these kind of twists in the story that you can see how it would really just add to kind of the paranoia of the times about the killing and the investigation of it. Because Anthony had a run-in with the law prior to his death, and it was about 6 months before he was arrested by undercover vice officers, and they'd charged him with prostitution, that he was soliciting a sex act for hire. And according to some of the police reports, supposedly was the it was a sting. That it was taped. It sounded like they made it sound like it was a pretty solid case. However, Anthony would not plead out to it. He would not plead guilty, take any kind of deal, and decided to take it to court. And he was actually scheduled to go to trial on October 31st. At the very last minute, they toss out the case. A week later, Anthony's killed.
Bob Waldrop told me that Tony had told him that he was set up, that he wasn't soliciting prostitution at all, that he met somebody on the phone line. They agreed to go to a motel to have sex. And while there, this other individual plopped down a $20 bill. And Tony said, I'm not here for your money and things. And at that time, the vice squad busts in at that time and arrests him. So that's his side of the story.
Yeah.
Right.
Complicated. I guess the question is whether or not there was a kind of hostility going on in the police department toward the gay community, toward the socialist community. What do you have a sense of that? I mean, what were you able to confirm, if anything?
Well, I mean, I think there was. I mean, there's a general sense, I think, that there's obviously some hostility there. It's hard to pin down specific instances, I think, of direct bias. Yeah, at the same time, I did hear a very kind of heartbreaking story from Tony's own brother. At some point, he'd actually was wondering what was happening with the case some months after it started, and he'd actually gone to the police station to ask about it, and the clerk there kind of just said over their shoulder, so he could hear something I don't even know if I should say on the radio, but referred to, that made a reference.
Blank.
Yeah. His brother is here, tossing out a homophobic slur, which does not speak well for, the general attitude, at least of some people at the department at that time.
And also, Bob Waldrop said that he heard somebody from the police department that actually called him to tell him that they heard the jokes going around in the police department about Tony Adams' death, saying that basically gay, socialist, black, three strikes, you're out. Of course, they didn't use those euphemisms. They used other more derogatory terms for this. And so there was a very strained relationship between the gay community and the police department at that time. In fact, it won't be until the late 80s is there even a sensitivity training things for the gay community. The police department at that time felt like they were trying to keep the morals of the city up. Mm-hmm. And homosexuality at that time was still kind of regarded like prostitution. Yeah. It was an immoral act that this state would be better off if it wasn't here.
So as far as you could tell, Eric Peterson, did the fact that that he had, as was put at the time, three strikes, Anthony, did that affect the investigation as far as you could tell? That's one of the things you looked into. You talked to a former detective, Ron Millard, who told you that he didn't think that this was a political assassination. He didn't think that it was necessarily a hate crime. He had other ideas. What did he say when you asked him whether or not this had been adequately investigated? I mean, what was the general response you got?
Ron had talked to me about it, and you know, he acknowledged that there were problems with the investigation. He acknowledged to me that you know there had actually been a couple detectives originally put on it, and then they kind of reshuffled around, and he just kind of put on the case. But you know, he did tell to me that you know, like that he did earnestly like look into it as best as he could. I found him credible. He also, as a matter of fact, in telling me that you know, it was not an easy case. That you know, it was his kind of feeling that there were certain aspects of Tony's life that he kind of kept secret from other people. And so sometimes people had different kind of understandings of who Tony was because, and I don't know if I'm qualified to say that, but I can imagine that that was probably a common experience among some gay individuals at the time. You know, there's still certain aspects, I think, of their lives that are closeted, you know.
Yeah, that was interesting that he had led, as he put it, a compartmentalized life.
Yeah.
Ben Williams, when you hear that, what do you think?
I think that's just the way things were at that time. I mean, you could be fired for a job for being gay. You could be arrested in the wrong places. People were being set up. You could lose your position in the church if you're LDS or probably any church at that time. It was kind of a frightening time to not compartmentalize yourself. And also there wasn't a whole – even though there was an emergence of a gay community, there wasn't really a huge support for the gay community. And definitely there were no allies at that time. And so people kind of kept their sexuality to themselves. And like I said, they were – I always said there was a lot more homosexuals in Salt Lake City than there were gay people. Yeah, you know, because people were not really identifying with a gay civil rights movement, or and they were afraid. The fear of the police was they knew that if they got attacked, that they wouldn't go to the police because the police wouldn't do much about it, or if they did anything about it, they'd have to acknowledge why they were in that position to have been assaulted in the first place. So it was more fearful of the police than reporting any kind of assault. And so a lot of the things went unreported.
Yeah. How significant is it that of the murders that occurred, and this is from your reporting, Eric, from the murders that occurred from 1978 to 1983, only three of the 17 cases have missing evidence? And this is an important part of your story. We'll get to that here in a minute. And those three cases where gay people were murdered, that's another striking fact.
I mean, I think it's very significant, and I think it's troubling. And I think it's indicative of a kind of a problem. I think that really is something that's more of perhaps like an institutional problem. You know, I think there were problems in a lot of aspects of the investigation that because it's a cold case and because it's four decades old, that, you know, I really, you know, I really wasn't out to kind of like indict current, you know, cold case detectives for faults with the investigation when they're working perhaps with imperfect evidence and lack of institutional knowledge about what happened exactly. But in like looking through this problem with the evidence issues, you know, it did occur to me that a problem that hasn't been really talked about is this issue with evidence from these cold case homicides and the fact that there appears to be evidence missing. And it's kind of astounding that all these three cases, for example, all have key pieces of evidence missing. And I think it begs out for, you know, some kind of better, more comprehensive audit of the evidence that the department has, and which, you know, the spokesperson there for the department had acknowledged to me, you know, after, you know, a lot of questions, a lot of records requests, a lot of, you know, trying to look at things I noticed in the reports that seemed kind of inconsistent, that they acknowledged, you know, we've never had the manpower to like actually do a complete inventory on the evidence
of this
kind of era, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what do they know about this evidence? Like where it went, how much? Let me be more specific. The particular missing crucial piece of evidence in the case of Anthony Adams is the murder weapon, or at least one of the murder weapons, a knife, right?
Correct.
And it disappeared.
Right. Yeah. And again, speaking to like, you know, kind of the problems that come with, you know, inheriting case files that are, you know, decades old, is that I can see how there was possibly some confusion. I mean, I got copies of the old police reports, and they made reference to certain kinds of evidence being sent to a lab at the U called the Center for Human Toxicology.
Yeah.
And in interviews with the detectives, you know, they explained to me that they had a big problem that a lot of evidence got sent to this lab and the lab just lost it somehow. And there was a doctor involved and he's since died and they don't really know what happened. And even at the beginning of this year, they had actually gone to the public, kind of put a public plea out and said, you know, we think evidence is missing from as many as 20 cold case homicides. If anyone knew this doctor, might know something, please reach out to us. But looking into it more, it seemed like, you know, after tracking down, you know, talking to the former director of that lab, you know, the detectives that worked those old cases, a variety of sources, it doesn't sound like that lab actually held on to evidence, that they would not have actually taken a knife and held on to it, and that was not actually what they did. And this was another thing that came out, you know, in talking with the police recently, is like they acknowledged like, well, that might have been 20 cases or it might have been zero that this lab lost the evidence. So there's at least the possibility that there is key evidence and it might be in the wrong box.
When I was interviewed about this by the Salt Lake Tribune, wondering about this knife that went missing and hoping that by doing a cold, reopening a cold case, that they would be able to find somebody that might know where this knife might be. But I was really skeptical at that time because I had been told years earlier that that knife went missing from the evidence room at the police department, not up at the lab or anything like that. So I had, from the information I had, and it's just rumor that knife disappeared at the time of the murder. Not.
So we don't really know where this evidence is supposed to. I mean, I imagine they do in a room or in boxes or in a basement. But what you're saying is it doesn't seem like anyone has the money to or the manpower to or have done any kind of assessment of this evidence that may or may not be there in some of these cold cases.
Correct. Yeah. Even in some of the documents that I was able to get, there was even a reference at one point, a detective on the Adams case, you know, made a note about a piece of evidence that had been misfiled in that box. So, no, these things can happen. It's just that no one has really gone through and, like, looked at each case, looked at the evidence, you know, looked at the sheet and said, oh, something was misfiled, or this got sent somewhere for testing, or this just isn't here, you know, and we need to find it.
Also, I think they were treating it really, truly as just kind of a murder and not really a gay hate crime. Even in even today, if you look up the cold case number, Tony Adams is listed as a member of a radical element. You know, nothing about being gay or, you know, a socialist worker party, but a member of a radical element.
One of the things you deal with in your article, Eric, is you talked with Michael Aaron, for example. He was an activist who started to document hate crimes against gay people. He's one of the initial ones who started pushing hate crime legislation in the state. And so what's the idea? Why is there a resistance to name Anthony Adams gay? Are they resisting the idea of it being a hate crime? I mean, can you tell?
Well, I think that's certainly I think that's a sentiment. I think that's a sentiment that really members of the community would have. It does open the door to saying, you know, that this could have been a hate crime. And that clearly from the start never seemed to be a theory the police entertained.
Hmm. You talked to the mayor's office. Her office offered Mayor Biskupski said that there is somebody, a spokesperson there, said that there isn't a funding problem affecting cold case investigations. What can you tell about this?
Yeah, in speaking with them, like I kind of brought up this point about like what the department had just told me directly, and it basically sounded like from their understanding, you know, they worked with the department formulating a budget and that this issue just hadn't been brought up to them. So, you know, they did kind of say, you know, we're concerned about cold cases and making sure those are funded in the interest of justice. But from what I gathered, as far as they know, there isn't actually a funding issue.
How many of these cold cases are there?
I was told when they were kind of like giving me the overview of the cold case squad and what they're looking at, they said there is around 100.
100?
Yeah.
I guess the question is, and this is something you get at a bit in the article, so there are these cold case files. Is anything being done? Do they have the personnel to even deal with a portion of that caseload?
Well, I mean, that's the interesting thing because I think they had at one point received grant funding, right? Like, so they had funding to do DNA testing and things like that. And they have had successes before. And ironically, like they had like the Sharon Schollmeyer case was resolved through DNA. And this was a young woman who was actually killed in the same apartment as Tony Adams. Police say they don't think that
there's a connection.
The connection there in the same killer. The thing was that I believe that, you know, they got the grant money, and so there were some people that would kind of look at different cases and say, this one might have something we could test. But again, I don't think there was – apparently it wasn't any kind of systematic overview of their evidence in a really comprehensive kind of way.
I know they put up some billboards in the city because I remember seeing one for Kerry Arbon, who was a gay man that was murdered up in Memory Grove area. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it affected the case or not, but I do know that they were doing billboards for some of the cold cases.
Let me ask you both, what effect did Anthony Adams, and for that matter, Doug Coleman, what did their murders, there were three actually, what did those murders, what effect did it have on the activism that was starting to get started? Eric says, Ben, in his article, that it became muted. What was your sense of what effect did all of that have on the
community? The times were changing in the late 70s that there was a backlash to the gay civil rights movement, starting with the Anita Bryant Save Our Children campaign. And so a lot of
We're beginning to see the beginning of the 80s and the sort of moral majority. And
cities that had anti-discrimination acts were starting to have them repealed. And so there was kind of a backlash to any kind of national gay rights movement. And here in Utah, because Tony Adams, contrary to some people, he was a very active gay person in the community and well-known in the community and had taken part in the Anita Bryant protests when Anita Bryant came to the state fair in 1977. Mm-hmm. So him being so well-known in the community, it really brought about a fear, especially after Doug Coleman. Now, there was more murders going on that Bob Waldrop said that he knew of four gay people that had been murdered in the city when he had talked to Bud Willoughby when they had their meeting in December. I've never been able to document who those people are, but nobody really put in their obituaries in those days that they were gay sometimes that they were even murdered. Most people became very low-key. The people kind of shut down. It took a couple of years for people who were not acquainted with the murder or Tony Adams to kind of revitalize the community in the 1980s. There was a period of about 3 years that there was a lull in the building of a gay community.
One of the things you mentioned to us was that older members of the community really withdrew.
Yes. And when I say the older members, we were all in our 20s when we were doing all this stuff. Yeah. You know, the pioneers that were doing things in the 1920s were very young people. They were college student age. They were bar-going people at this time. They were mostly in the 20s. Anybody in the 30s came out of the old school that you don't rock the boat at all, you don't mention anything. But because of these murders, it kind of shut down a lot of these younger people, and they just decided to go on with be quiet in their lives, to go on with their careers and dating and things like that. But to go and be a face, you know, in the media, those days were over.
Yeah. What was your sense, Eric, of how far it set back the community?
Well, I mean, I would have to agree with what Ben was saying, and I mean, that was based the same thing I heard, you know, from talking to other people, is that it seemed like, it just based on the research, that like there's a certain momentum that was really picking up, you know, and then it just kind of got checked, you know, it stopped for a while, and I think it's obviously a tragic thing, it's a sad thing. It's also encouraging to know that, you know, that the community was still able to rally within a few years from that time. And I think some of the things people had told me was, probably the early 80s AIDS epidemic starting to happen. And that kind of gave something that the community could say, you know, we need to get a little more political active again. You know, we need to start organizing a little bit more, because we've got this peril that we kind of need to address.
Right.
So, you know, it's on the one hand, it's absolutely tragic that, you know, a series of murders could, you know, cause people to just kind of retreat to the shadows as far as, you know, speaking their voice, you know, representing who they are to the world. But it's also encouraging, at least, that, you know, they're able to rebuild, they're able to come back.
That retreat, though, was really based on the fact that they were afraid of authority. They were afraid that they were not going to be protected. And whether it was true or false or the rumor, and the feeling of that time is that they couldn't trust the police for whatever reason. They just felt like they were not going to have justice, that they were not going to be treated as equal partners in this community. And so they kind of went back underground.
Yeah. What happens to the case now? Any sense of whether the article and this new attention could move the needle some in the Anthony Adams case?
Well, I always hope something like that will happen. And you know, any new attention, I think, could be really helpful. And I hope if there's any real meaningful discussion about the status of the department's evidence, you know, I think that could bear some productive fruit, you know, especially for a number of cases. You hope that something like this will help, and You know, if nothing else, you know, if this case remains cold, I hope at least the story remains something vivid, something people remember. I mean, this is part of Utah's history. And that was something that struck me a lot in researching it, that as I got into more how kind of shocking, how interesting, you know, how sad it turns, you know, it was to look into. I realized this felt like it was a chapter that we can't forget about. And I'm sure Ben would agree with me on that. Like, it's something more people need to be aware of and know that this was part of our history.
It's Eric Peterson. He's the executive director of the Utah Investigative Journalism Project. His articles about the murder of Anthony Adams appeared recently in the Salt Lake Tribune. We have links to those, by the way, on our website. Eric, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Ben Williams is an independent historian of Utah's LGBTQ community. He writes about the state's queer history for Q magazine. You can find links to all of that also on our website. And Ben Williams, thanks to you.
Well, thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Tim Slover is our technical director today. Our thanks to Holly Vasek, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.